Remind me not to leave again. Okay. Chugging right along. We're up to chapter 2. Okay, let's start it again. We were beating around the bushes like yesterday, taking care of all sorts of side problems. Let's push straight through as much as we can. The purpose of creation, why did God make a world or anything, is to express loving kindness, to do good. Now, what is good? What is the good that's going to be done? Since He is perfection, He is the greatest good. So, as we said yesterday, if we do this simplistically, just go with the words. If He's going to do good, and He is the greatest good, and of course He's going to do the greatest good, He should do Himself. He should make God, more God, more gods, some gods, something like that. That's how we would be doing the greatest good. The only trouble is that when I say those words, and even if you said them, you're saying a contradiction. Because if something is made, manufactured, produced, created, then it isn't perfect. Perfection includes at least being self-sufficient, not depending on something outside of yourself. So I can't say X will be produced and X will be perfect. That's a contradiction. And if we talk in contradictions, it don't make sense. So it's not recommended. So we have to describe it another way. A way in which we won't be contradicting ourselves. So here's what we say. God will produce an X which will be as perfect as a produced X can be. A produced X can't be totally perfect, because being produced is inconsistent with being perfect. So it'll have to be a produced X that'll be as perfect as a production could be. Some features a production could have, which are similar to God's features, and that would mean it would be godlike, it would embody some of godness, so to speak, and it would participate in God's good. Other features can't do it. So, God's purpose being to do good, do the best good, the highest good, the most perfect good. Now we just put in one qualifier, the most perfect, consistent good. We're not going to contradict ourselves when we describe it, because then we don't make sense. The most consistent, the most perfect good that's consistent is to say God will produce something, and that thing will be as good, as perfect as a production can be. So that's the project. The project is to produce something that is as God-like as a product can be. That's what human beings are. Human beings are that product. They are more God-like than anything else. Certainly more than horses. And also more than angels. More God-like than anything else. Now here, I'll take your question one second. Mm-hmm. Here we have an illustration of something I told you the day before yesterday. Here's where Lutzato goes behind a verse in the Torah, doesn't just take the verse in the Torah for granted as an axiom, no. He has a deeper perspective from which the verse is a consequence, a theorem. It's not an axiom. What verse do I mean? See if anybody's still awake. God created us in His image. Okay, the Hebrew word doesn't mean image, it means form, sharing His characteristics. Why did He do that? Why did He create us in His form, sharing His characteristics? Why isn't He satisfied with horses? The answer is that if all you have is horses, then God isn't doing the greatest good. Because horses share very little with God. I'd say, almost nothing. to do the greatest good, he's going to create a production that will be as perfect, as godlike as a production can be. Well, a horse is very low down on the ladder. God could do much better than that in producing a creature that could embody some of God's characteristics. So when it says in Genesis that God created us in his form, sharing some of his form, something like that, that's an application of this deeper idea. That's roughly what we got to yesterday. Yeah.
So we said that man is greater than angels.
Yes.
In what way?
Okay. I haven't told you in what way, what aspects we're sharing. I haven't gotten that way. But the first one I do will come out clear immediately in which way.
I'm not sure if it makes a difference, but does it have to be that there's something created and then God improves it, or is it that God creates something already improved? It sounds like that you, when he benefits something else, it sounds like the thing is as it is, and then God benefits it to raise it up. Or does it not have to be that way?
It doesn't have to be that way. In fact, if it takes time, if it's a process, and the goal is only achieved at the end of the process, I think that's worse. Then we have to ask, well, why didn't you achieve it at the beginning? What did you need the whole span of time for? And indeed, if the realization of this goal is in Olam Habo, in the world to come, then I need an excuse for this world. And that's something that the Sadhu works with. You know, if the goal is there, why doesn't God go straight to the goal? Why does he have to go with an intermediary stretch for? Now, I just want to point out that here, Rabbi Kaplan, I think, has made a terrible error in his translation. What I'm explaining to you is in the middle of the first page of the second chapter, it's page 36 in the Hebrew. And what he says is, Lo yistapek chefso hatov, God's good desire or intention will not be satisfied unless he benefits the other with the tov, that very good that is in him, in God, because he is the greatest perfection. Then Usata goes on to say, however, or behold, from another angle, from another side, that good, the good that is in God himself, is impossible that it should exist other than in him. Now at this point we have a problem. Because in the previous sentence he said God's purpose will not be fulfilled unless he gives that very good that is in him. And now he says, from another angle, that good that's in him can only be in him. So how's he going to give it over to somebody else? So what we have here is a contradiction. Now, Rabbi Kaplan introduces the second statement by saying, this is also true in another way. It's not also true in another way. It's a contradiction to what we just said. And then he resolves the contradiction by saying, God's wisdom decreed that there should be an aspect or a similarity or a development of his own good that's available even for creatures, because his exact good can't be possessed by creatures. So he's raising a problem and giving a resolution. He's not saying the same thing in other words. And here I think Rabbi Kaplan's translation is just wrong. The description he gives into the next page is this. We can't possess God's perfection. We have to have something that will make us godlike or participate in God's perfection. This is done in two ways. I told you yesterday that I don't fully understand this chapter. Now we're coming to the thing that I don't understand. He describes it in two ways. Both seem correct, and both seem important and necessary, but I can't figure out how they're related. That's my problem. But at any rate, one is that they're similar. What we have is similar to what he has. The other, he says, is this. That any perfection for us is not only similar to his, but it grows out of his, like a tree goes out of a root. It's an extension of his. It's an application of his. So that when we get for ourselves characteristics that are similar to his, it's not just we are separate in different universes, in different planes, in different dimensions, but there happens to be a similarity between this and that. You look here, look there, and say, well, you know, they do share some characteristics. No. The similarity that we get is something that crosses the planes. He has perfection, or maybe perfections, and as they are in of themselves, they apply only to him. But they extend themselves to our realm, and they manifest themselves in a step-down, toned-down, reduced way in our realm, so that they're capable, we're capable of achieving them. And when we achieve them, then we are connected to him. We are related to him. Not just similar to him, but separate. But we are, as he says, like grasping the branch connects you to the root. There's one solid entity between the branch and the root. Someone who holds on to the branch is really relating to, connected to the root. Connected to the root through the medium of the branch, but he's connected. So we get two ideas here. One idea is similarity. The other idea is dveikus. Dveikus means, dveikus I know, it's the name of a pop Jewish band. But it's more than that. Dveikus means connection. In modern Hebrew, dveik is glue. Dveikus means being connected to something. The goal, one way of describing the goal, is to be connected to God. That's dveikus. And by achieving these creature perfections, these relative perfections, these limited perfections, we become both similar to God and also we become connected to God. Now let me give you an illustration. This gentleman asked, in what way do we have features that are superior to the angels? Here's one that's important for itself and is also the key to all the others. We did start to talk about this yesterday. Self-determination. Self being self-defined. Self-determined. God is what he is only because of himself. Nothing causes God, nothing makes God, nothing creates God, nothing changes God, nothing transforms God. He's totally self-contained and self-determined. It is possible for a creature to have something of that. Something. Not the whole thing, but something. A creature couldn't be totally self-determined because, think carefully, give me the deepest answer. The answer in terms that I've spoken about up until now. Why couldn't a creature be totally self-determined?
Because he's relying on something else to create him.
Because he's a creature. Because he's created. If he's created by God, then he isn't totally self-determined. He's only there because God makes him. So he can't be totally self-determined. Okay. So the creature is going to have only limited ability to be self-determined. What is it in our makeup? What is it in our nature, human beings, that enables us to be somewhat limitedly self-determined? What feature of us enables us to be something, have some level of self-determinism? Free will. When a human being exercises free will, he determines for himself what he will do. And if you think about it more deeply, he determines for himself what he will become. When you do something, you have an effect not only in the outside world, you have an effect on yourself. Your actions contribute to your self-development. When you act, you are self-creative. It's as if part of you is created blank. Not the whole thing, like Locke thought with the tabula rasa, but part of you is created blank, and you can fill in the blank. So that later, that part of you was created by you, by your choices. Okay, so now, here's the picture. God is self-determined. How is he self-determined? Why is he self-determined? Because his existence is absolute, perfect, totally independent. That's how he's self-determined. How are we self-determined? Through free choice. The hows are very different. Don't make a mistake. I think maybe in previous series I didn't explain this clearly enough, and I led to people making mistakes. The similarity here is only in the what, not in the how. The how of his self-determinism is because he's perfect. The how of ours is because of free will. We're not perfect, and he doesn't have free will. But the end result, that he's self-determined, and that we're self-determined, that's so. Now, here you can see an illustration, at least I would call it an external illustration, of what I said before. Is there a similarity between us and God? Yes. Quite a negative similarity, that there are certain things about me that I do for myself that are not caused from the outside. And for God, everything about Him is due to Himself and not caused from the outside. But when you think about the hows are very different. So what you're seeing is God's perfection of being self-determined translated and projected into our world and changed considerably so it could be relevant to us. He can't give us His perfection, but He can give us something that's related to it. So He takes the fact that He's self-determined and projects it into our world. In our world, it's translated into free will, which for a creature is the only way the creature can become self-determined. So what you see is a kind of analogy, a point of similarity, the what, the point of difference, the how. And then Lutzato tells us it's not just a matter of similarity and difference, but it's His perfection projected, like from a root to a branch, into our world, so that when we act on it and we do it for ourselves, we are connecting to Him. We are achieving dvaitas in Him. That's how the picture looks. Yeah, Chris.
Yeah, I think you might have explained it just now, but you said that free will is what's been translated to us. So what about free will are we saying that God doesn't have? Or to us, what do you mean by we? That's translated. He also has.
He has will, but he doesn't have what we call free will. I don't know if we can describe the background or the mechanics of his will at all. As you'll see, the mechanics of our free will don't apply to him at all. So we're not going to be able to. He certainly doesn't have what we call free will, human free will. Okay, you with me so far? Yeah.
So if he doesn't have a choice, then he can't.
If he doesn't have a choice, he can perfectly determine what's going to happen. He can perfectly determine what's going to happen.
But nothing else.
Right? Free choice just means that you can determine two things. If you don't have free choice, you have only one choice, then you don't determine it. It means you determine it without alternatives. That doesn't mean you don't determine it. It doesn't come from anywhere else. It comes only from Him. Now, that gives us one point of comparison, one point of relationship with God. He's totally, absolutely self-determined, and we are partially, relatively self-determined. But I said it's more than that. It's more than that. We want to share other characteristics with God, moral characteristics, spiritual characteristics. Okay, time for a short quiz. If we're going to share moral, spiritual characteristics with God, part of relating to His perfection, can you think of one, a likely candidate, that we should share with Him? One we know that He has and is very important?
Justice?
You're close, but you're guessing. What moral characteristic does God have that we know is very important? Very, very important. Very, very, very important to Him. And therefore, should be, very high on our list. Yeah, I mean, the purpose of the whole creation. How about that one? If that's the purpose of the whole creation, that's really very important. And that's certainly a moral characteristic, chesed, loving kindness. So that's why He created the whole universe. You see now, compassion was just a guess, although it's close in meaning. So clearly, we should be working to develop our own chesed. In that way, we'll certainly have a very important point of similarity with God. Good. Now let's reflect. What does it take to have the moral quality of chesed, of loving kindness? Let me illustrate the question. Let's imagine that I have programmed my computer with a virtual agent which searches the internet for information. And I have a mail group of 500 friends. And every Thursday night at 2 a.m., my computer sends out this information to these people all over the world. Just because I know these people find this information useful and interesting. And I do it as a sign of friendship. Now, Ruben in Melbourne opens up his computer Friday afternoon. By Friday morning, you know, it's not even night, Thursday night over here. Yeah, he opens up his computer Friday afternoon, and he opens it up, and there's all this information, articles from Nature and from Science and from, you know, Wall Street Journal, all those good places. And he says, wow, Gottlieb's computer. Gottlieb's computer is so kind. Gottlieb's computer is so generous. Gottlieb's computer is so loving. Look at that. His computer sends out all this stuff free every week. Gottlieb's computer is very virtuous. I hope you share with me a sense that something's wrong here, right? That's not quite right. It isn't the hunk of metal and plastic and electricity that's sitting on my desk that is kind and generous and sensitive and virtuous. It's a hunk of metal, etc. It doesn't have any moral characteristics. Maybe I qualify, you know, as kind and sensitive and generous and virtuous, but not the piece of metal. Why? Because the piece of metal has no choice. Piece of metal makes no decisions. It's totally programmed from the outside to function like a machine. Because it is a machine. And therefore it gets no credit for what it does. No moral credit. To get moral credit, you have to be able to make a choice. I don't know if squirrels share their nuts, but if you have imagined that a squirrel falls from a tree and it breaks its leg and the winter's coming and it's going to starve, and the other squirrels get their acorns, you know, they contribute some acorns, whatever, so that this injured squirrel can starve. That doesn't mean that the other acorns are generous or virtuous. They're doing it because they're programmed to do that. Their instinct is programmed to do that. And therefore, they don't qualify as virtuous squirrels, and if one squirrel doesn't do it, then he's vicious and maybe should be punished. Because a squirrel is just a very fancy computer, that's all. They don't have any free choice at all. So to have the quality of chesed, of loving kindness, you have to have free choice. So free choice is doing two jobs here. Number one, free choice is giving us the quality of being self-determined, and that quality is already a connection with God and already a resemblance to God. And number two, free choice is making possible all the other qualities of resemblance. Chesed and justice and courage and all the rest of them, which in some ways will be related to God's perfection. Free choice underlies all of them. Without free choice, we wouldn't be able to resemble God at all. That's why a horse is not godlike. Without free choice, we wouldn't be able to resemble God at all. That's why free choice is so crucial. It is the key to all resembling God. And since resembling God is the way in which God is doing the greatest good, by making a creature that's godlike, free choice is absolutely fundamental. Now here again, every writer in Jewish sources affirms that God created us with free will. Very few bother to explain why. And even those that explain why, it seems to me that this is perhaps the deepest perspective on why there has to be free will. Because the whole project of bringing into existence a creature that will share something of God's characteristics, that project can't get off the ground unless we have free will. Okay? Who did I ignore a moment ago? Somebody's hand was up.
Yeah. So you're saying that since, I mean, how can you say that the squirrels are programmed, but we aren't? Like what is suppose some of the squirrels gave the acorns, but some of them didn't? Why would you say that they're being programmed, but we're not?
Well, this is a topic that's really, it's a long topic, but let me put the shoe on the other foot. We feel that we are not programmed. Everyone, especially before he's poisoned by philosophy, everyone takes it for granted that he makes choices, and that very often, not always, but very often he looks back and says, I did it this way, but I could have done it that way, and that's why he feels regret that he didn't do it. We deliberate, we think this way, that way, we think about it, we make a decision, we change our minds. This is the evidence that we have free will. Okay? Now, if somebody wants to tell me that it's not true, he owes me some spectacular argument to show me how everybody in the world is misled about this. There might be some spectacular argument. There might not. Philosophy is very divided on this subject. There's no argument that's universally accepted. But this is the reason that we look at ourselves as having free will. Now, when I look at animals, I don't see any of those reasons, ever. I don't see animals deliberating between one choice and another. I don't see animals regretting and thinking that they should have done it differently. I don't see them making choices. None of their behavior indicates that they're making choices. So I have absolutely no evidence that animals go through anything like this. And I have lots of evidence that we can go through something like this. So on the face of it, there is this gigantic difference between us and animals. Now, as I said, somebody wants to tell me that really the animals are considering whether to read Shakespeare tonight or whether to go to the opera, or the mice who go in the timbers. You know, shall we go to the opera timbers tonight, or should we go to the reading, the Shakespeare reading tonight? If that's really he owes me some elaborate, some gigantic set of evidence that I don't think exists. And if he thinks that our feeling of free will is an illusion, he owes me some kind of gigantic argument. But on the face of it, just looking at the world as we see it, there seems to be this gigantic gulf between us and animals. Not only this one, there are many others, but this one surely. There's nothing in the behavior of an animal that indicates ever making choices.
Yeah, I'm still confused. Go back when you said that God does not have free will, did he make a choice to create us?
He willed it.
He willed it.
But willing something and free will are two different things. I didn't say animals don't have will. I said they don't have free will. We always talk about free choice. The word free there is not free. The word free there is not idle. The word free is a qualification. So
so you're saying this is not the word, the phrase is not applicable to God. It's
correct.
Correct. It just doesn't fit.
That's right. That's right. Okay, yeah.
Because animals are made up of the same material as humans on a physical level, and because the humans have free choice because of some aspect of the frontal lobe or the anterior cingulate cortex, or, you know, whatever people have been discovering, then is it possible for an animal to eventually, throughout time, develop the faculties to actually start to make real decisions? We haven't seen it, though.
Oh, so this is the crucial thing. Now, what I want to recommend to you and to all of you who heard his remark is to pay very careful attention to one word that he used, which is extremely important, and that's the word possible. I would say almost always. Somebody says, isn't X possible? The answer is yes. Sure it's possible. I mean, I'm inclined to think anything's possible as long as it's a thing, you know, as long as you don't contradict yourself in talking about it, but if you don't contradict yourself, I might think that it's possible. Is it possible that trees are in agony when you chop them down? You're causing unbelievable agony to these poor trees that are suffering when you chop them. Is that possible? I guess it's possible. I wouldn't know how to rule it out for sure.
Has retroactively substituted reasonable?
But then you yourself said we have no evidence for it. So then, of course, it's not reasonable. Possible? Anything's possible. Reasonable? I've got to have evidence for it. Now, you know, it's very interesting. You say we're made of the same stuff. I want to tell you something, a remark that I saw in an essay by Rav Shach. A very interesting remark. We look at the differences between human beings and animals, and we think of them as showing that we are something fundamentally different. Rav Shach made a remark just like yours. He said, no. Biologists will come to say that we are animals with special animal capacities. Look, eagles fly and mice don't. They're both animals. Okay, but this animal is equipped in such a way as to have the quality of flight, and that one isn't. That doesn't mean the eagle isn't an animal. So, the fact that a creature has certain unique capacities doesn't necessarily mean it's not an animal. Right? Okay, so now we have flatly contradicted what you said. Because what you said was, if we're made of the same stuff, we should expect that we can do the same things. And what I just said is, you can be made of the same general stuff, and indeed, not be able to do the same things.
Yeah. I was thinking on a chemical level, molecular level, not necessarily physical, like manifesting the greater organism as a whole, but the processes that occur within the organism itself.
You know, I mean, I don't know how much further I'm going to go with this because this is really a scientific debate. Yeah, they'll tell you that certain chimpanzees and we share 98.6% of our proteins. So then, gosh, you know, we're just fancy chimpanzees, right? What they don't tell you is that we and yeast spores share 70%. So that means you're just a very upgraded yeast. Probably not, you know. I mean, I think, you know, even if it's only 30%, still, that 30% does a gigantic amount. These yeast spores are what turn grape juice into wine. You know, they sort of sit there and grow and chew up the sugar and make alcohol. That's not at all like us, is it? What these people have done is committed a terrible fallacy. They've taken one dimension, the proteins that we work with, and looked at it and said, they're very close. And they've ignored everything else and said, well, if that's so, then we really must be very close. So human beings and chimpanzees, you know, it could be next door neighbors. But there's another way to look at it. The other way to look at it is to say, we are obviously very, very different from chimpanzees. So what we're discovering is that 1.4% difference in proteins can make a gigantic difference in output. And then go to examine how such a small input can make such a big difference in output. Now, you all know this from computers, right? You have a computer programming that's running well. Now, just substitute for one line a line of nonsense. The whole thing crashes just because you changed one line. How could changing one line make such a big difference? Because it's a very integrated system. It's a very interlocked system. And in an interlocked system, make one change, the whole thing can go to pieces. Or you can get out systematically the wrong results. You know, if you type in nature to your search engine, you get one thing. If you type natures with that, you get entirely different results. Why? I just added an S. Because the search engine is sensitive to every letter that you put in. So what we really should have said is, look how gigantic the difference is between human beings and chimpanzees. And if so, what we're learning is 1.4% difference in proteins can make a gigantic difference in output, and look for the mechanisms that bring that about. And then they discovered what they call regulatory genes, where a single mutation can have a gigantic effect on the whole organism. I mean, as they began to realize how this works. But, you know, the 1.4% sounds so utterly scientific. And Shakespeare and the Mona Lisa and cosmology, you know, that's all fluff. How do you quantify that? How do you put numbers on that? So the 1.4% wins, and the fact that human beings produce Shakespeare and the Mona Lisa and hydrogen bombs and war and things like that, you know, that just gets ignored. But that's ridiculous. That's all part of the data that has to be explained. Okay, yeah. They certainly are. But now notice that you have used a weak qualified word, predisposed. Predisposed says nothing about whether the ultimate choice is mine or whether it's programmed entirely. I wouldn't say that squirrels are predisposed. I would say they're programmed. Right? My computer isn't predisposed to send out the material on Thursday night and maybe once every 2 months decides to take a vacation. No, it's programmed and it does it, period. Now we definitely are predisposed. As Ramchal will say, In order to have free will at all, you have to have conflicting motivations which push you in at least two different directions. If you don't have those conflicting motivations, you don't have any free will. So of course we're predisposed. The question is not whether or not predisposed. The question is whether after being predisposed, we are the ones who control the final outcome. And that's what's being asserted. Yeah.
Talking about the tree before, what about all of the drashim where like mountains talk, and are those not meant to be taken literally?
This is a key point. You can't tell how to take a midrash unless you look at the commentators and see what they make out of the midrash. And yes, I would say that the mountains talking and the rest is not meant to be taken literally. It's meant to convey a thought that's related to the mountains. It's not meant to be taken in straightforward literal sense. No. Yeah.
When you mentioned before about animals and we're made up of the same stuff that animals are made up, and then you said that take an eagle or a mouse, they're both still called animals and they're made up of the same stuff, but they're totally different. So then, are you saying that the free will we've been given is a physical quality?
I'm sorry, this is my fault. I was in the middle of a dialectic with him, and I was making a move against him on the basis of his assumption. I wasn't expressing my point of view. Right? My only point was that from a scientific point of view, the fact that we're made of the same stuff wouldn't lead a scientist to say we have all the same abilities. He himself would agree that being made of the same stuff allows us to have very different abilities. He wanted to say, well, since we're made of the same stuff, we have to assume that animals are capable of free choice. No, we don't have to assume that at all. Anybody have to assume that a mouse is capable of flying. All right, are we together? Terrific. Let's see if we can do a couple more lines. Oh, but these are the hard parts. The first two chapters are the very hard parts. In the third round, we'll go a little faster. Okay. So this creature, since it has to achieve its perfection for itself, stands with the possibility of going in two directions. Going one way, it achieves it creates perfection for itself, and going the other way, it loses that perfection, or destroys that perfection. Now, I'll do that later. Since this creature, I didn't answer your question. That's what I was thinking. And he asked, in what way are we superior to the angels? So, from what I told you, that falls out pretty fast, right? In what way are we superior to the angels? We have free will. Free will is necessary to relate, to be similar to God at all, to acquire any perfection at all. So only we have the ability of being godlike. If the angels don't have free will, yes, I stuck in an if. If the angels don't have free will, then they're not in the running, you know. Although, in other respects, vastly superior to horses, in this respect, they're on the other side of the line with the horses. Now, I put the if in because some of you have come across this, and if you haven't, you will. Maybe angels do have a kind of limited free will. Someday you'll read the Chumash with Rashi, and you'll read, as we will a couple of weeks from now, the story of the angels that come to Abraham and receive his hospitality, and then the two of them go to Sodom to destroy the city, and they come to Lot, who's supposed to be saved, and they try to get him to come out of the city, and Lot is reluctant, so business. And they say to Lot, well, we have to get you out of here because we are destroying the city and we can't do it while you're there. So the Midrash says, what? You're destroying the city? Get real. You know, you're not destroying the city. God is destroying the city. And it said they were punished for that. Later on, they had to say, we can't do anything. Lo ucha, I can't do anything. So they had to say, I can't do anything. As an expression of admission, that really, it's not up to me, I can't do anything. Now, you read that and you say, wait a minute. In fifth grade, in day school, they taught me that angels don't have free will, you know? So what do you mean? He should have, and he didn't, and he's getting punished for it. The answer seems to be this. The idea of an angel is something which is defined by its job. Angel is defined by its job. That means to imagine an angel not doing its job is imagine an angel that just winks out of existence. The angel is defined by its job. If the job isn't getting done, it's not there. But that's only with respect to its job. Suppose there are peripherals, you know, suppose there are preliminaries. It may not be programmed with respect to the preliminaries. God programs the angel, assigns the angel, defines the angel to one angel to rescue Lot, to the other angel to destroy the city with God's power. What words to speak in doing that? That may not be programmed. So on the peripherals, the angel may indeed possess free will and may indeed be punished for making mistakes of that kind. But that's free will as a peripheral. That's free will as an incidental. Why God would give that kind of free will to angels, I don't know. But it exists at all. It's very minor in that respect. Howell, in another book, which is not translated in English, says that angels are programmed in terms of what they do, but not their intention when they do it. The intention they can choose, and therefore they can be responsible for it, they can be punished for it. So when the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, which also is a kind of an angel, what should the intention of the evil inclination be? So there's a Zohar on it. The Zohar says something like this. Imagine a king whose son, the prince, is mature, and the king wants to test his son to see whether he's worthy of becoming the next king. So he hires a prostitute, and he says to her, your job is to seduce the prince. Do everything you can to seduce the prince. Now, says the Zohar, let's analyze it from her point of view. What is her feeling about what she's doing, or her conception of what she's doing? She has a job. She'll be paid well for this. Her job is to try to seduce the prince. Does she want the prince to succeed or fail in resisting her? Well, if he succeeds, then he shows that he's a worthy king for the country. Everyone benefits when the country has a worthy king. Everyone benefits. So she really wants it to succeed. Of course, she has to do her job. She's paid by the king to seduce him, so she's going to do her best to seduce him. But she's hoping in her heart all the while that he'll be able to resist her. That's the way it ought to be. Now, says Ramchal in that other book, Das in the Space, Understanding Heart, Part 2, the one that's not translated. He says, the Satan, the Yetzer Hara, has the choice on his intention to intend to seduce in order to test and hope that the prince will succeed, or to try to pull him down and kill him. And here, he has free will and could be punished for making the wrong choice. So either way, either it's like Rashi on peripherals, or it's like Ramchal on intentions, but it's nothing approaching the kind of free will that human beings have, where you can actually create yourself by your exercise of free will. Yeah.
How can an angel have a hope or desire if they have no existence outside of what they're doing, what they're ordered to do?
So now, Rav Dessler, in an essay, says that... I'll tell you this tomorrow, but I'll just give you the headline. In order to have free will, I said a moment ago, in order to have free will, you have to have motivations pulling you in opposite directions, right? That's the conflict, inner conflict, pulling you in two different directions. This is why I said that God doesn't have free will, because he doesn't have that kind of inner conflict. Okay, it's another aside. Now, the way in which a human being has conflict, what's pulling him in the two directions are, can you guess? Right, the evil and good inclinations, and in terms of his build-up, in terms of his makeup, they are his soul and his body. Because he has both the soul and the body, he can be pulled in two directions. Because he can be pulled in two directions, he can have the freedom to choose which direction he's going in. Now, if angels have some kind of peripheral free will, it ought to follow that in some sense, angels have a body. And Rav Dessler says, yes, indeed, they do. Indeed, for anything to exist, I'm choosing the one word only, different from God, I didn't say independent, I said different. For anything to exist different from God, it must have, scare quotes, body. Something that could be qualified as body. Okay, it doesn't have to be sticks and stones or pebbles or protons and neutrons, but it's got to have something that can be qualified as body, otherwise it can't be different from God. So, since they'll have something called body, then they'll have the capacity for something like free will. because they have the spiritual side as well. Right? The animals are out because they don't have the spiritual side altogether.